And we're back. Mike, and Oscar rolling along. Welcome. I am your host, Mike. This is my co-host, also Mike.
Check.
Mike, check. I get it. And we're doing this Oscar sprint profile thing like we've been doing, hopping along, doing all the big movies, getting all the big categories, likely nominees out of the way, so get you ready for Oscar night 2018.
It's nice to finally podcast about some happy subject matter for a change,
Jesus,
I think.
Christ, yeah.
You know, right? We got Northern Italy, 80s dance music, summer romance.
Armie Hammer being the fucking sweating to the oldies guy. He is the best.
But a few of everybody's favorite things.
That's what we're doing today in Call Me By Your Name, the Oscar Sprint Profile, the vehicle that is getting Timothée Chalamet all the love in the world. And if you go back to our Golden Globes nomination episode, we talked about how he's sharing the nomination for Best Lead Actor with some titans of the industry. Gary Oldman, Tom Hanks, Denzel Washington.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Daniel, to Christ almighty, yeah. Daniel Day-Lewis, and then Timothée Chalamet. So
he's up with a Mount Rushmore of great actors.
Yeah.
But, he's holding his own in a lot of these precursor awards. He's also, in terms of his performance, I think he's up there. And he's having a great year. Lady Bird and Hostiles as well.
We're going to talk about all that and a bag of chips. So sit back, relax. This is Call Me By Your Name, our Oscar Sprint Profile. Oh, God. Going to have a lot to say about produce and the way to treat fresh produce. But before that, let's get a production profile as we do every episode. We'll start off with Mike. Go ahead.
So the story inception, after reading a draft of the upcoming debut novel by Andre Aciman, producers Peter Spears and Howard Roseman, they bought the rights to Call Me By Your Name all the way back in 2007, before the book actually came out. They contacted Luca Guadagnino a year or so later. This is before I Am Love, but they knew him as a Italian filmmaker that they respected from a few Tilda Swinton movies. Tilda Swinton's like in every one of his movies. And they just wanted him to coordinate the Italian side of the production. I wanted to see if it was feasible for them to actually shoot this thing in Italy. The book doesn't specify where the setting is, so there's a small villa in Italy, or villa means mansion.
It's a small, small wooden ship.
It is a small little town. Commune? No, that's France. I don't know. I'm from there, but I don't know. Still,
need to work on our Italian, I think.
Still, Guadagnino kind of takes the reins in terms of the Italian side and becomes a full-blown producer on the film. He grabs James Ivory, one of his friends and heroes, as he mentions throughout the promotional interviews, and gets James Ivory to write the script, and basically wants Ivory from Merchant Ivory Productions, A Room with the View, etc., etc.
Not from the soap.
No. He wants... That's a terrible joke. Why am I laughing so
hard? I don't care. You do what you got to do. I'm going to do what I got to do.
I'm an easy laugh. Anyway, James Ivory is writing the script, but Guadagnino, I just feel like he's Kramer, and he keeps butting in.
I feel like you pitched the Kramer analogy to a lot of people on these podcasts.
I watch a lot of 90s sitcoms in my daily life, my everyday.
He's Paul Reiser from Mad About You.
Why are they bringing that back? Frasier.
Why are they bringing Mad About... Did you see that? They're bringing Mad About You back? A little quick diversion.
Well, they brought Full House back.
That's not an excuse.
They brought Will and Grace back.
Yeah.
They brought... They're bringing Roseanne back.
Which I'm excited about.
And soon to be Academy Award winner Laurie Metcalf is going to play.
Gonna go right back into her role. Show. Yeah,
John Goodman's done like 1,000 things
love him.
Since.
He's an American treasure. Guy's been 450 pounds for like 50 years.
Good for him.
Love him.
Fat and happy.
We need to preserve him. He needs his own wing in the Smithsonian.
Anyway,
what are we talking about?
Ivory and Guadagnino, they co-write the script together in 9 months. After they finished, they decided to co-direct the film together. So Guadagnino is like gradually getting more and more into this project, and you know, they're sucking him in.
Smart.
To the job.
They laid that bait out there, and he's just yapping it up, and they're becoming an integral part of this movie.
They're able to sell more people on the screenplay, on the whole project in general now. Originally, they were in development hell. Failed to mention that. They were in development hell. They had a lot of problems. They get Ivory
You would
attached.
Think with a script like this, if they want to play it as true to form as they did, it's going to, you know, especially in the early 2000s, with all the half measures being taken, a lot of the studios are going to turn their nose up at the idea of making it. Glad they finally got it done.
It was much more explicit, sexually explicit, at this time as well, both in the screenplay and in the novel. So it was a little bit of a hard sell. However, the novelist Asimov approved of the screenplay. He said, and quote, it was direct and real persuasive. And he added, wow, they did better than the book, unquote.
So, interesting. I
mean, he was a big fan of it.
He gets the blessing. That's cool.
Production companies finally gather, and they get several on board from France, Italy, Germany, Brazil, and the U.S. to finance the film. However, the budget they were going for, $12 million, scaled all the way back to $3.5 million. At one point, Shia LaBeouf is attached, and he's supposed to do it. He kind of gets in trouble.
Could you imagine if this was a Shia LaBeouf movie?
He did the Lars von Trier movie instead.
Yeah, he definitely explored his sexuality one way or another.
So this is the third in Guadagnino's Desire trilogy after I Am Love, which I have not seen, admittedly, starring Tilda Swinton, also in A Summer in Italy setting. It was nominated for a Golden Globe and for Best Foreign Film, and nominated for an Oscar for Best Costume Design. A bigger splash, which I just really like, and I watched the other night because I couldn't help myself, with one of the all-time greatest performances by Ralph Fiennes. Tilda Swinton is in this again. But if you haven't seen A Bigger Splash, definitely check that out.
That's and don't go in expecting the sequel to Splash. It's not what you'll find in this movie.
No. So Guadagnino's career is interesting. He's doing Suspiria next, a remake of Dario Argento's.
I am so... I mean, after seeing this movie, I have more faith because I wasn't really that familiar with Guadagnino to begin with. But, man... You're going to redo Suspiria. You got to tread lightly. That is going to be a property that's going to be very interesting to see how it goes through production and how the end product turns out.
I like plot as a writer. You know, I like good stories, and I don't love The Bird with a Crystal Plumage. I don't love Suspiria as a story. So, I you know, visually, I think it's, you know, absurdly,
yeah, it's
eye-poppingly ridiculous.
It's not about story.
So I wonder if he's going to pull it together. So that's my curiosity.
Horror remakes are the big thing. They're making money, as we saw with It. Go back to episode one to hear us chat about that.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, Luca Guadagnino finally decides to direct the film, jumping back a little bit. And he takes out a lot of the nudity in the script. He quote, wanted the audience to completely rely on the emotional travel of these people and first feel love. It was important to me, Guadagnino says, it was important to me to create this powerful universality because the whole idea of the movie is that the other person makes you beautiful, enlightens you, elevates you, unquote. So, I mean, he definitely...
You can call them by your name, if you will.
Yes. He scales back kind of the explicit nature of it. He makes it more palatable for large audiences. Both Timothée Chalamet and Armie Hammer had nudity clauses in their contract, so that they kind of sign on. It allows them to sign on in all their contracts, that is. So anyway, another major change from Ivory's script was to take away most of the voiceover narration. And this is always a plus.
Yeah, not something that we're overly thrilled with when it's done. It could be done well, but this movie didn't need it.
Thankfully. I mean, can you imagine Timothée Chalamet talking about the peach?
Yeah, and just
and
like
describing it.
Going all sensually into the microphone like this.
Yeah. Or Armie Hammer like, oh, now I'm going to see what's what with Elio there. I'm going to put on the short shorts.
The short shorts
are getting
everybody. Everybody that wore a pair of shorts in this movie was outstanding. I should have been born in the 80s and just let my thighs ride.
I'm not quite sure about this guy. The short shorts will tell me.
The dress in this movie was
outstanding. Those are his closer shorts.
That's your Oscar category alone. Best costume design.
Those are his closer shorts. Anyway, Guadagnino wanted to replace the voiceover narration with music. So it works with the 80s dance music soundtrack.
Yeah, music plays a big role in this movie, not even with the soundtrack, but also as a means of flirtation between the two main characters and a means of expression. Mm-hmm. You could see that it's very influenced and tied to music.
Psychedelic Furs song is a great song. It always been a great song. It always will be a great song. But yeah, Sufjan Stevens, he was asked to actually take the place of the voiceover narration. Guadagnino gave it to him and basically asked Sufjan Stevens to replace it. And he was supposed to, you know, create one song for him. He created three.
I feel like if Also Mike doesn't catch on for you, we should just start calling you Sufjan.
That's a hell of a name. Anyway, Guadagnino didn't want it to be considered a quote, gay movie. He pitched it as more of a universal love story.
That's the message I got. I mean, look, it's not a movie intended for immature audiences, and as you know, we're able to put our childish behaviors aside when it comes to reviewing these things. This is a love story through and through. I mean, that's right. What you get with this movie. That message came across very clearly.
Yeah, I mean, this movie wouldn't, on the surface, be made for us, two straight white guys.
No, not with our sophomoric behavior that we've displayed.
But displayed like, so far.
Like I said, I mean, it's when you sit down and watch this movie, if you expect to get, you know, oh, it's a gay movie, it's going to be gay propaganda. That's not what I got out of it at all.
Yeah, to jump forward into my expectations, it was not a difficult movie to watch.
No.
And rewatch.
And it's well done, too. I mean, it's, yeah. You know, it's good. Yeah.
So we were, it was a pleasant surprise in that regard. Guadagnino called it. It's about the newborn idea of desire, unbiased and uncynical, unquote. So I'm trying to include as many quotes from this guy as possible. He's someone who I've watched a lot of interviews with this whole season. He's very interesting. So if you do get the chance, check out all the promotional stuff. There's a ton out there. Guadagnino also considers the film an homage to fathers, referring both to his own father and his four primary influences in his filmmaking life. Jean Renoir, Jacques
doing a beautiful job with
Rivette,
names, by the way.
Eric Romer, and Bernardo Bertolucci.
The hardest name I have this whole time is Mike. No, I mean, and it's, you know, we're going to talk about performances too, just to tease a little later, like you just did. But Michael Stuhlbarg's performance as the father in this movie is one of the main performances. It's very powerful and very moving.
Bertolucci's, I have a love-hate relationship with him. I really did not like The Last Emperor. I know some people like it. Some of his other stuff back in film school days is undeniably
swept, right?
Good stuff. One Best Picture.
But Last Emperor was the one that swept all nine, wasn't it?
Right.
Be right. I think that was nine for nine.
So the final few nuggets on the production part is that they have announced the sequel already. I have no idea when it'll get made. This might be 10 years
from
now.
That's news to me.
But apparently the book's story is told in the novel through flashbacks. Older Elio flashes back in his adult years to this.
Which is interesting because you're certainly not left on a cliffhanger. I mean, you're left on kind of news and interpretation of the news, right? That's not really...
Right.
Doesn't leave a whole wide door open, but who knows?
This movie could exist on its own.
Yeah.
But I can see a sequel. And he, in the recent promotional video that I watched, I think it was New York Film Festival, he teases the sequel coming out.
Going to be interesting. Is there a sequel book, or is it going to be his
own
creation?
Well, the book has another story involved. There's two narratives, I guess. There's one when they're older and one when they're younger.
So it's like It.
It's like It, exactly.
same type of movie.
I have a few miniature biographies here, more filmography than biography. Timothy Chalamet plays Elio, 17-year-old musician, son of the great man, the great professor Michael Stuhlbarg. Chalamet was born in Hell's Kitchen and son to a real estate agent / former Broadway dancer as his mom. And
these people just keep having the same backgrounds.
A French father who works for UNICEF. Chalamet's uncle is Rodman Fletcher. And get this, Rodman Fletcher is the director of The Unborn, Leprechaun 2, Idle Hands, and a whole bunch of TV. From The OC, Gilmore Girls, The Office, MTV's Scream, to Party of Five back in the day, all the way to he directed the newer documentary Conan O'Brien Can't Stop. So he's had quite the career.
Yeah, that's
Uncle Rod.
Eclectic.
Uncle Rod. Chalamet's aunt is Party of Five producer Amy Lippman. His grandpa was also a screenwriter back in the day, Harold Flender. Chalamet's been
kind of born into the industry.
Born into the industry. Chalamet's been a child actor, and after going to a performing arts high school, he attended Columbia for a year, which was basically kind of, it was a designed, he didn't drop out, it was a designed year of study where he kind of, Columbia offers programs to soon-to-be movie stars.
Yeah, when it comes to, like, you know, people that have their lives together and are on a track professionally.
We'll gladly take your future donations for 1 year.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
Could you dedicate your Oscar to us, maybe?
Chalamet's filmography includes some short films when he's very young. So that's kind of interesting that this kid even knew, or his family knew how to get him started. He did short films first that caught fire on the festival circuits. And he breaks out with 8 episodes on Homeland, in the 2000s.
It's not a show I have ever dove into because I'm too torn by all the reviews that everybody that watches it tells me about.
I love the first season.
I love the first season, but it trails off afterward. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I love the first season. I don't think I even kept watching it after the first season because I probably heard the same stuff. Anyway, he took character parts in a bunch of movies last 5 or 6 years. Interstellar for Christopher Nolan. Kind of an attention-grabbing role last year in Miss Stevens. Very solid movie, very weird movie, I guess you could say. This year, Chalamet has starred in 3 major award season movies, like I said, Hostiles and Lady Bird, along with Call Me By Your Name.
It's almost like he's like the $6 million, like he was created in a lab specifically to win awards for his movie performances at some point.
Yeah, I mean, look at what he's coming up with next. He's got a movie called Beautiful Boy by an esteemed foreign director, who I forgot to write his name down, but also Woody Allen has him starring in A Rainy Day in New York, which will also star Ellie Fanning.
And he's also only 22, so it goes without saying, but he can go to hell.
He's going to rule the world.
Yep, screw him. Bastard. We hate him.
Anyway, Armie Hammer.
Incredibly talented kid.
Armie Hammer is Oliver, the visiting grad student in this film. Armie was born in Santa Monica, California in 1986. He is the grandson of an oil tycoon and philanthropist.
Shocked my mother to learn that he was both Winklevoss twins in the Social Network.
Yes. And his dad owns a publishing and production company, both. He owns two companies, one that
it's an importing-exporting business, you see.
Guess. He has a brother named Cameron Winklevoss, as you said.
Created Facebook.
Hammer's great-grandfather also founded the Communist Party in New York. It's an interesting nugget there.
Well, everybody needs a hobby.
His family coming to the U.S. As Russian Jewish immigrants. Way back when. He got his start in acting, Armie
they
Hammer.
They came here as Russian Jewish immigrants and then founded the Communist Party?
And took a whole bunch of oil out of the ground. And
all right.
Formed a publishing company and a production company.
And we make podcasts.
And gave us Armie Hammer.
All right.
So anyway,
Everybody needs a hobby, man.
Armie Hammer got his first acting role in Arrested Development. Go figure. Went on to bit roles.
That keeps on giving.
Yeah, it's a funny show. He went on to bit roles in Veronica Mars, Gossip Girl, Reaper, and Desperate Housewives. Hammer got.
He really hit the melodramatic, all those early 2000s.
That is a genre in its own right.
All over your TV screen.
Hammer got his first starring role playing a young Billy Graham in the Christian movie Billy the Early Years. You seen that one, Mike?
No, it escaped me. I'm sorry. I was on my to-watch list, and I must have just skipped it.
666 just appeared on your forehead. I'm not surprised.
Armie Hammer, I mean, incredibly talented, and I actually enjoy most of the stuff he does, but he's got to be an athlete with that name. Like, you're a prospect if you're named Armie Hammer.
His great-grandfather was Armand.
Armand Hammer?
Armand Hammer.
Like he should be a young quarterback or something with Armie Hammer. Drops the hammer.
You're not wrong. Armie Hammer was attached to one of the most anticipated superhero movies in a long time for a lot of years. Throughout the late 2000s, he was set to star as Bruce Wayne / Batman in the director of Mad Max, George Miller's Justice League, and that never happened.
I don't want to see him do that.
Instead, we got Zack Snyder's Justice League.
I also don't want to see that.
That was terrible. Nah, it was okay. 2010, Hammer got his breakout role playing both of the Winklevoss twins.
What?
David Fincher's and Aaron Sorkin's The Social Network. Hammer hasn't exactly hit it big as a blockbuster movie star. The Lone Ranger and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. didn't exactly... they didn't work at the box office. Clint Eastwood's J. Edgar, another movie that leaves you wanting, even though his performance earned him a lot of critical and award season acclaim. He got a SAG nom for that part in 2012. Some of my other favorite Armie Hammer roles includes last year's Nocturnal Animals and Free Fire. I thought he was good in both of those. In 2018, he'll play Martin Ginsburg, husband of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in quotes on the basis of sex. He'll also star in the thriller Hotel Mumbai, about a true story, and then to round it out in a sci-fi comedy, Sorry to Bother You. That's Armie Hammer.
I want him to, like, he's really good. I want him, he deserves
him to take
it. Yeah. Come on, man. Let's get this rocket to your back. Let's go. It's just a string of bad luck with those, the Lone Ranger and those big ones.
True. Michael Stuhlbarg, quickie bio on him
as well.
We
as a human race do not deserve Michael Stuhlbarg.
He's awesome. He's been in phenomenal. Every good movie so good of everything. Like the last 15 years. I mean, he is having a Tom Wilkinson-like 10 years
yes.
here.
And this cast, too. I mean, I love Armie Hammer. I love Michael Stuhlbarg. I wasn't familiar with Chalamet, but he's really good. Like, this is a great cast.
They crush it. So, born in Long Beach, California, son of Susan and Mort Stuhlbarg, Michael mentioned during one of his Q&As for Call Me By Your Name that after a childhood for performance, his father, Mort, told him, quote, "You have to do this." So, I mean, he had a lot of support from his father and mother, and it shows because look at how many schools the kid went to. He goes to Juilliard for his bachelor's. Then he studies further at the University of California in Los Angeles, the Vinnius Conservatory in Lithuania, the British American Academy in Oxford, and the University of London.
Holy shit. Wow.
So, yeah.
He's well learned.
And he studied, I forgot this, he studied mime under Marcel Marceau.
Stop it.
Truth.
That's serious?
Wikipedia says so.
It must be true.
Stuhlbarg began his theater career young, but began gaining traction in 1996.
Get to the part where he's selling heroin on the boardwalk.
he did Long Jay's Journey into Night in 1997. He did The Pillow Man for Martin McDonagh in 2005, which Timothy Chalamet often references having seen as a kid and something we talked about in the Three Billboards, Martin McDonagh.
A little crossover there with our Three Billboards Oscar profile.
Yeah, he received his first Tony Award for The Pillow Man in 2005. Stuhlbarg began a movie career back in 1998 with A Price Above Rubies. He was also in The Gray Zone, which is an intense movie about the Holocaust.
Come on.
And some TV with Law and Order. Then he really catches fire as a character actor in 2006. Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, working with Aaron Sorkin, famously canceled show, but a lot of those actors went on to do well. 2009's A Serious Man is his breakout performance for the Coen brothers. He was nominated for a Golden Globe and a whole bunch of other stuff during that award season. Hugo, Men in Black, Seven Psychopaths, Lincoln, Blue Jasmine, and of course his big role as Rothstein in Boardwalk Empire. Those are his next 5 years.
Yeah, that's not bad, right?
That's just 5 years. After that, he does Steve Jobs, Arrival, Doctor Strange, and of course the season 2 of the Fargo TV show, which aired this year. So his year now is Fargo, Call Me By Your Name, The Shape of Water, and The Post. He's coming out in The
How
Post.
How does he have time?
Dude is crushing
it. Yeah.
He's currently filming the TV series The Looming Tower, which is about the rivalry between the CIA and the FBI before 9/11 as they track Osama bin Laden.
So I'll be watching that.
That sounds pretty cool. Yep. He's also set to star in a movie, Gore, which is about Gore Vidal. He doesn't play Gore Vidal, but he's in there. Call Me By Your Name also stars Amira Kazar as Elio's mother, Anella, Esther Guerrell as Elio's girlfriend, Marzia, Victoire Dubois, and Vanda Capriola.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you gave the long profiles about the men, and we try to be carrying the flag for the feministic equality as much as we can, but this is a very guy-carried movie. This is a very man-centric theme.
Right. Even though I added both female performances to my list, I thought they were terrific. I thought the young girl, Esther, was awesome, and the mom is... It's got a lot of subtle little nuggets to throw at it. I'm going to get into those.
And this is going to make me sound like a bad person, but I viewed the mom more as just kind of like the mirror for Stuhlbarg to kind of throw his emotional
weight
at.
Well, she is. She's definitely a foil for her husband, but she's got a lot of great scenes with him as well. But this movie is so subtle, and we'll get into it. You have to kind of analyze it. Anyway, to finish up, production notes, principal photography for Call Me By Your Name began in May of 2016 in Crema, Italy.
They did shoot it in Italy. That's good.
Anyway, this was close by to the director's hometown, or it was where the director was living at the time. Some of the shoots actually took place in the guy's own neighborhood. So he mentions
had to be fun for him.
Yeah, he mentions over the promotional interview circuit that it was like a dream come true.
I live there. Yeah, that's my house.
He shot, you know, the film like down the street from where he lives. The actors were like, you know, you could drive across this town in like 10 minutes.
I'm amazed he was able to get any shoots done because, you know, you would think if he's in his hometown, a lot of people would be like, hey!
The fairly short shoot, like a month and a half shoot, Chalamet arrived over a month early to kind of relearn the piano, the guitar, and learn for the first time the Italian that he needed to know. I mean, he knew the piano and the guitar.
Go play a video game. Go throw an egg at a car or something.
The kid's a talent.
It's like he's the younger version of what Stuhlbarg is now. You know, like these guys just created in these labs to be awesome actors, and that's where the path is going.
Yeah, many of the scenes are silent in this movie or play out kind of wordlessly. On that, Guadagnino says, words are a part of what's going on. I think the film celebrates the underneath, though. So apparently Chalamet and Hammer only had one rehearsal for this movie, one true rehearsal.
Jesus Christ.
So they were there for 3 weeks. They bonded. They hung out. They kind of went around the city. So for the one rehearsal, they told this story 100 times during the promos. Luca Guadagnino kind of takes them out to the villa, the mansion, and he says, okay, let's do scene, 74. And they're like, oh, yeah. They're all pumped up. They're ready to go. And then scene 74 reads out, Elio and Oliver roll around in the grass and make out.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
So they're doing it, and then the director gets in the... They're like, all right, this is why we're here. We're committed to this. We're doing it. Fine. So they do it. And then Guadagnino, rebukes them. He's like, you guys are not doing it right. You got to be more passionate. And they're like, okay. They get into it. So they're doing this for like 10 minutes. They get up and look around, and Guadagnino's not even there anymore.
Oh, jeez.
He just left them there. So that is the production profile.
Thanks, director.
I'll send it to you now, Michael.
Oh, man.
Like I said, wacky stories from the promo.
Going in with no rehearsal on that. This kind of movie with this much intimacy is... That'd be a stretch. Well, they both delivered. Call Me By Your Name, written, as Mike said, by James Ivory, screenplay based on Andre Esserman, directed by Luca Guadagnino, debuted January 22nd at Sundance and went wide on November 24th. Sony Picture Classics were the distributors, and 132-minute runtime for the film. Mike said a $3.5 million budget. Wikipedia said it's grossed $4.6 million last check, but according to Box Office Mojo, because I do my research on my research, because that's how professional
nice.
I am. I'm a bad person. It hasn't made back its budget yet. Box Office Mojo only has it at $3.2 million.
It's only in a few theaters still.
Yeah, it's
going to rake it in.
Right now, good for 159th highest grossing domestically of the year.
We're actually getting ahead of this one, like before it goes wide.
Look at us. Yeah, we're pros.
Some review numbers. For what?
Some review numbers. It'll be no wonder why this is so heavily featured to hear its name come Oscar time. 8.5 IMDb rating on 13,000 plus reviews. 97% certified fresh Rotten Tomato rating with a critic rating of 8.8 out of 10 on 206 critic reviews. Audience score of 89% on Rotten Tomatoes with an average score of 4.4 out of 5. A 93 Meta rating from Metacritic, good for the fourth highest Meta rating amongst films this year.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with a big, heavily loved property.
Serious contender.
Its awards profile as far as contending goes. 3 Golden Globe nominations. Supporting actor for Armie Hammer, lead actor for Timothy Chalamet, and Best Picture Drama. It did get 1 SAG nomination as well for Chalamet and lead actor. 8 Critics' Choice nominations. Best Song, Best Cinematography, Best Director, Best Supporting Actor for Hammer, Best Supporting Actor for Michael Stuhlbarg, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Lead Actor for Chalamet, and Best Picture. This movie, I'm not going to be surprised to hear, is a favorite in the clubhouse, so to speak, as you can tell by the 3 big precursor award shows and the push for Timothy Chalamet to win the lead actor award. Now, we mentioned in our Golden Globes preview pod, like I said at the top of the show, that he is in with some giant Oscar-contending names. It's his relative neophyte in Chalamet that is playing David, but has the momentum of Goliath right now. He's probably not the current favorite to win the category, but in a year where the names Hanks Oldman, Daniel Day-Lewis, and Denzel, and others are absurdly famous men, have put forth great performances for Academy Gold, it's been Chalamet who's getting recognition time and time again.
Yeah, it's not Oldman. Oldman is said to have this Daniel Day-Lewis-like performance, and honestly, the tease of The Darkest Hour a little bit, it's not a Lincoln-like performance. It's good. It's really good.
As more eyes, and I've said it a couple episodes, as more eyes get on
debate.
The product,
there's a debate. I mean, this kid does a great job in this movie. I shouldn't call him a kid, but he does a great job.
He's 22. I mean, he is a kid,
Right, yeah.
We're too old. That's all it is. We're just too old.
I don't want to sound like James Woods either. Anyway, are you ready for my projections?
Once, let me just finish up here.
No!
All right, go ahead. Including the 3 big award shows I mentioned already, Chalamet has heard his name nominated for Best Actor some 32 times for either Best Actor or Best Breakthrough Performer of the Year in all the critic circles, having won his nominated category 13 times, even including 1 time which he won for not this movie, but for his Lady Bird performance.
Yeah, he's hysterical in that. It freaking kills me. That's one of the funnier performances of the year.
He's very good.
Yeah, this kid can act.
There's been some conversations and obviously some nominations for both Stu Bart and Artie Hammer for their supporting actor work, but this film clearly is a vehicle that runs on two engines for award seasons, one being its best picture chances, and with that, will Hollywood finally embrace the 100% issue feature in lieu of awarding the half measure, as it's done time and again, and Mike and I touch on often,
right?
And Chalamet's chances at scoring the upset and taking home the lead actor award.
So here's what some of the projections are saying at the moment. On Gold Derby, which accumulates the critics that are weighing in and projecting this thing, 25 out of 26 have it up for Best Picture in their top 10. 12 out of 27 have Luca Guadagnino in for Best Director. 27 out of 27 have Timothy Chalamet nominated.
Wow.
And 4 have him getting number one. So a lot of Gary Oldman love still with the critics. 19 out of 27 have Armie Hammer getting nominated for Best Supporting Actor. 16 out of 27 have Michael Stuhlbarg, including 2 firsts for Michael Stuhlbarg.
Hammer has more nominations, but Stuhlbarg has more number one finishes right now.
Yes.
That's interesting.
26 out of 26 on Gold Derby have James Ivory and Guadagnino up for Best Adapted Screenplay, and 23 of those 26 have it at number one. So that's
wow.
That's the most likely award it's going to get. We mentioned before, it's Disaster Artist, Wonder, movies like that are Mudbound. They're being put up there in the top 5 for Best
you would
Adapted
think
Screenplay.
Come Oscars night.
Little softer category, yeah.
This is going to cure its name for Adapted Screenplay. Chalamet is definitely going to hear his name at least nominated, and you would think that this is clearly a Best Picture nominee.
I think it's going to win Adapted Screenplay, like everybody says. Feinberg Forecast has it as a front runner for Best Picture, Actor, Supporting Actor, Hammer, and Adapted Screenplay. They have it as a major threat for Best Director, Supporting Actor Stuhlbarg, Cinematography, Film Editing, and Best Original Song, one of them by Sufjan Stevens. So, Mikey, what were your expectations for this one going in? I kind of touched on mine a little bit already.
Yeah, I'll tell you what I didn't expect was, like, probably the most gripping love story of the year that I've seen.
Yeah, me neither.
I mean, I said it's not a gay propaganda movie, and it's really not, but that's kind of what I was expecting going in. You know, an embrace of, a movie that kind of stands on its own because it's a gay love story.
I thought it was going to be an issue movie, and I kind of referred to it in previous pods. I was like, this is going to be an issue movie, but it's really not an issue movie.
No, not at all.
It doesn't spend the last third in a courtroom or in a hospital.
And it's not him wanting redemption for or wanting his father's love because, Michael Stuhlbarg plays an accepting father that really, he knows about his son.
Guadagnino called it like an ideal. You know, the last few movies in this Desire trilogy he characterized differently. They're much more controversial, much more edgy, I guess is the only word for it. And this movie he characterized as an ideal, and he wanted universality. So yeah, I wouldn't quote-unquote call it a gay movie.
In the way that, like, we praise The Last Jedi because as being highly feministic because they were just strong-willed leaders who happened to be women, this is like a great love story that happens to be between two guys.
Right.
I was
a little surprised at myself for watching this movie and enjoying it twice. Here's something that I will say. I could do without the sound of the lip smacking throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like, this is a very quote unquote sensual movie, literally.
Yes.
You can hear it. You can taste the food they're eating. You know, and it definitely, all the lip smacking was that's just me being a heterosexual guy.
Yeah, but you don't want to hear that if two heterosexual people are making out either.
Yeah, it bothers me. It's just like,
you don't want to. Yeah.
For the whole damn movie. Yeah. And with the peach.
The peach is going to come up in its own scene.
We're going to talk about the peach, but the peach somehow worked, and we're going to tease that for spoilers, and we're going to tell you why the peach scene worked. I can't believe I'm saying that. Production value. Yeah, I mean, this guy had the balls to say, all right, American Pie. I'm going to take that cliche that everybody's mocked for the last 20 years. I'm going to make it the most artful scene in the movie.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And I had to ask you, I'm like, was this referenced like it was an American Pie? But no, it wasn't. It was
through
just
the promotional videos, he didn't know if he was going to include it. He didn't think it was so brazen.
Well, I think it's the most memorable scene in the movie. I don't think that's, we'll talk about our favorite and worst scenes later,
right.
But yeah, that was interesting. I didn't see it coming, that's
how
for sure.
Do you make a kid fucking a peach? how do you make that work?
And look how far you've come, because between gritting your teeth and not being able to make it through the full Monty in our episode one.
I was upside down on the couch watching a full Monty.
Yeah.
And this movie,
Hollywood liberal elite.
I'm insecure about a thousand things in my whole world. So this movie, I did read the content advisory on IMDb before watching it. So I knew, and I watched a few like non-spoiler reviews, so I knew it wasn't going to be explicit sex. So it put me at ease a little bit. But I mean, listen, I mean, it was straight women watching Blue is the Warmest Color. I get it. It could be a little abrasive for us to watch it, but
yeah. But I mean, overall, it was, and that's where Guadagnino's vision comes in, because right. It was handled really well.
He wins me over, and these guys win you over throughout it. Production values.
Yeah, let's talk about production. We want to go sight to sound first.
Either way, sight to sound, cinematography. Goddamn you, Northern Italy! I want to be there.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. But I mean, I don't know. It's going to make me sound like a dick. How hard is it to make Northern Italy look beautiful? I mean, you know, you did a good job of being transported back in 1983, which is where this movie says it started.
I enjoyed the production design because it's kind of timeless. Like, you don't think it's an 80s movie this whole time. Like, you only realize it's an 80s movie.
I mean, the costumes alone kind of put you in 1983.
He's wearing, like, a Lacoste. I don't know. He's wearing, like, a Lacoste shirt, and they're wearing... I mean, listen, those short shorts are...
Beautiful.
They go through phases.
Need to get me a pair.
Like, those short shorts are really 70s, right? 70s, those are like throwback shorts.
I don't know.
The 70s.
I was born
in the
80s,
back,
so.
They've come back in, you know, this last decade now. So Italy looks like an ancient city throughout. But I'll be honest, like, a bigger splash, I don't know when that movie is set. I
mean, right.
And a bigger splash is modern day, and this movie felt like a bigger splash until you go to the dance party and you hear the psychedelic
and
first.
I would think in the dance party is where I would see I was most in the 80s.
Until he turns on the TV and you're watching the silly Italian sing-alongs
right.
that are obviously 80s. So yeah, that's when it comes in.
Not a lot of technology in this movie either. I mean, there was no electronics.
They're living the good life.
But yeah, there was nothing really...
They're living a good life, eating fruit, swimming.
Reading a lot of books, doing a lot of hand research, going through slides.
Feels like the son of a professor. You know, they wrote him well. He's the son of a professor. He's very into his music. Elio is.
And that's the context for those of you who haven't seen the movie yet. Michael Stuhlbarg is this university professor.
Archaeology professor, yeah.
Armie Hammer is like his star student who won this internship to hang out with Stuhlbarg for the summer, do some research with him, help him out in getting files in order and whatnot. And Timothy Chalamet is Stuhlbarg and his mother's son, who is also with them in Italy where this research is taking place. And then relationship blossoms between between Chalamet and Armie Hammer.
Yes, yes. Good job.
Thank you.
Wise. You didn't look down. That's a good job. So, yeah, I mean, the production values aren't going to win it a ton of awards.
I'm surprised to hear it's getting recognition for cinematography because, to me, and Guadagnino kind of said it in one of the quotes you said, I mean, the movie is about the times in between dialogue, and it's about the emotion delivered between the actors, and it's about the love story that letting it time to bloom and seeing what happens and their kind of forbidden love that
right.
they both know they share.
Listen, I mean, the score works, the visuals work.
They were fine.
He does really take his time with this movie.
Oh yeah,
and
I was bored. Listen, for the first 50 minutes, I was bored. I'll be honest.
I engaged more with the last hour of the movie as well, but the opening, he plays with conventions so well, like conventions of a normal script. This guy is not going to hit those beats hard ever. He never hits those beats hard. Like, I was listening to critics talk about there's no inciting incident on page 15. Well, I mean, it's a romance, so the inciting incident is when the other character arrives, and that happens earlier than that. You just need an inciting
incident.
There's
no antagonist.
Somewhere.
I mean,
well, the antagonism...
Society?
Here's the thing.
Conventions?
Like, well, the antagonism is that the romance, you know, will it, won't it happen?
Right.
But
I mean, that's what I...
There's no antagonist. There's no, you know, fire and brimstone preacher yelling at him, like we said. There's no...
Yeah. no
antagonist in the sense
loveless
that,
father that hates his gay son. No,
right. Yeah. Stolberg's getting everybody knows that by now. Stolberg's getting praised for the portrayal of the father character.
You even brought it up. He has a speech, and we'll get to it in spoilers. But he has a speech that he gives to his son and the Chalamet character. That's really. You know, it shows you just how accepting he is.
Guadagnino mentioned it as an ideal, and it plays through, but he does hit conventional scenes for a romance, for a...
And that's why I say this is such a powerful love story. I mean, you can, regardless of your feelings about homosexuality versus heterosexuality, you can relate that these are two characters that are deeply in love with each other, that know that what they're doing, that are trying to fight their feelings for one another.
I can't believe that... This subject matter would make me flash back to my own life,
right.
My own summer's past.
It's very relatable. It's unbelievable. That's a great point.
I can't believe it. I'm shocked.
Because everybody has
and
that.
And that's a me problem, being shocked.
Well, no, but that's part of watching this movie, because I think everyone at that point, they're, you know, mid to late 20s, early 30s, they have that, like, the one that got away or that one summer fling that everyone can relate to, the passion shown in this movie on one level or another, and it's very...
And they both characters deal with it in different ways. And these characters are so distinct. Like, Armie Hammer, coming from America, has more...
Not the Eddie Murphy movie.
his is more... he plays troubled very well throughout the early goings. Yeah, like, they have this flirtation, this courtship that they can't resist.
And that's where the
that
forbidden
builds.
Part comes in.
Right. And the antagonism is... within both of these characters, you see
more
them wrestling
so within Hammer, I would
with
say,
different things.
But
Chalamet's wrestling with different things. He's realizing it for the first time.
Yes.
And he's kind of needs it confirmed.
Whereas Hammer knows what happens if he goes down that route.
He's very wise to it and very.
He's aware of how it's viewed in society
but
and how
he's resisting and repressing it in himself, which is.
And yet at the same time, they both want the same thing.
And they're both doing a tremendous job playing these different sides of the coin.
Now, that said, the love story, and this goes back to what I said about being kind of bored in the first half, the love story, and when they give into their emotion to kind of do what happens from there in the spoiler section, I didn't feel a lot of that push and pull tension throughout the first hour that he wanted you to feel.
It's,
I just felt
it's
like it
subtle.
Was,
yeah, it's subtle. It's
like in
not
my mind, it was like, just get to it.
He does quite a good job gradually building it up. Like, it does it. They don't need to hate each other and then love each other. They don't.
Right.
There's some a push and pull. There's some there. Like, you know, they get into little spats about, you know, Chalamet's piano playing.
Exactly. They flirt
through
music.
A box song
yep.
that he plays on the guitar, and they have a little back and forth.
But that's
there.
The thing. It's kind of child. Like, it's like. It's first grade flirtation where you make fun of the girl you like in class, you know? Like, it's just do it. like adults,
but,
get to it.
You know, Oliver does give him the cold shoulder a little bit. Mm-hmm. But they both kind of gradually realize what's happening.
Yeah, and that could be a me problem, too.
And they both win each other over
be more
in a believable way,
action.
Though. That's I will say, they do win each other over in a way that sells the audience. Like, I was glad to see that. Like, this is not... this is something you're rooting for. This is something
oh,
you're rooting
for. Sure.
For to
for
happen,
sure.
And they do a great job carving these
and
characters
and that's
out.
Also a credit to the... I mean, not only to the actors, obviously, but a credit to Guadagnino
I mean,
as
it's
well. And the fact that there is no antagonist,
right.
All there is to concentrate on is the love story. So it's not like you have any kind of ancillary characters that you're worried about.
That's why this has to win Best Adapted Screenplay, because that is inherent to novelistic storytelling. Mm. You're dealing with some
really
of the best
point.
Novels out there. You're dealing with a psychological internal conflict. It doesn't externalize at all times. And not a great source material to adapt into a movie or something that you would think
very difficult,
is,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, there's no bad
concept.
Guy.
Right, exactly.
Just for purposes of the best adapted screenplay, it's contenders or who it would be up against. You got disaster artists, like Mike said, Mudbound, Molly's Game is seen a lot, All the Money in the World somewhat. I kind of feared the All the Money in the World momentum. We saw it kind of play out with the Golden Globes nominees because of what Ridley Scott was able to do in replacing Kevin Spacey in that movie, or Kevin Who, as he's known now in Hollywood. So, I mean, that might worry me, but you're right. I mean, if Logan, Wonder Woman, if those are the competition, you would think this has a leg up just in the difficulty of execution and how well it was pulled off.
Another thing on that regard is the characters are flawed, you know.
Deeply.
Armie Hammer's Oliver is totally full of himself, which makes sense. You got this graduate.
But when you're
student.
That good looking, I would be too.
To wear the goal of those shorts.
To wear those shorts and dance that dance. Armie Hammer has no business acting. He needs to live out his life's intentions, which was he was put on this earth to dance.
I mean, listen, apparently that dance scene was like one of the most awkward parts of the entire shoot because he had only like a click of something for the camera just to. For have the dancers keep time. They didn't have the song playing.
Oh, God.
So he's so, you know, doing how many takes
so
of that
goddamn
scene.
Talented.
And, you know, he's very, very self-conscious because he's 6'5", having to do a, you know, a dance. He thinks he's like Frankenstein on the dance floor. So the guy, yeah, I mean, he pulls it off, like you said. We want to save the best and worst scenes for spoilers?
Yeah, we'll save those for spoilers like we've been tending to do. I mean, do you have anything else you want to get through the non-spoiler section? You want to just dive into it?
We both give it a watch.
For sure. I mean, look, you're going to go into this with some preconceived notions one way or the other. You're either going to be someone that is accepting of this and is very liberal, or you're going to be a conservative and maybe have an issue with it. But whether you do or not, if you go into this viewing it as a love story, you're going to find enjoyment and you're going to find aspects of this that are very interesting, either from a filmmaking perspective or even just from a story perspective.
Now, one last thing I do want to bring up is that, and James Woods did it in a very, you know, asshole way.
Boo.
Where he talked about the age difference. And this is not something that's flown under the radar. The age difference is something a lot of critics have brought up. Award Circuit has mentioned it on their Circuit Breaker podcast. For one, they dealt with it head on in their podcast. So these characters, I think, are on a level playing field. This is not the situation of a 24-year-old grad student who's a school teacher and this kid's a senior in high school. This is not an unequal playing field, like I said, where there's like a power dynamic going on here. But the age difference between the actors is 31 and 22. Between the characters is 24 and 17. The age of consent in Italy is 14 to this day. The age of consent of much of the United States is 16. Mm-hmm. Of some of the United States is 17. And in several states, it is still 18. Japan and Germany is also 18. So this could be an issue geographically. It's something the world is still kind of wrestling with. There's a lot of exemptions. You know, a lot of lawyers know better than I. But in California, for instance, it's 18. In Connecticut, it's 16, I want to say. I mean, this would be fucked up if, in any way, shape, or form, Armie Hammer was a teacher or was a therapist.
Right. Level playing field is a good way of putting it. But there's
no issue
it's
in that
two
regard.
People. Yeah.
They're both coming to each other on different terms. It's hard to tell. Like, who, if you had to analyze who seduces who.
I didn't even know he was the 17. I figured this was the 18-year-old kid that was right. Just, you know, so I mean.
Yeah, he looks a little younger, but it's really not an issue. And honestly, I look 33 every day of it. You know, Armie Hammer doesn't look 31.
I have seen some things.
The dude looks younger.
No, Armie Hammer does not look 31. Yeah, it's 31, yes. Yeah, good lord. All right, let's hit the
I look 43.
Let's hit the Artie Hammer flow dance music and get you some spoilers. Spoilers ahead.
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike, and Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
All right, so we got the, hope you pulled out your best Oliver dance moves, and we are in the spoiler section of Call Me By Your Name. This is where you go for the twists and turns of this movie and this grand opening love story. If you want the non-spoiler section, you've come too far, go back, listen to the first 40 or 50 minutes or so of this show. We'll give you everything you want to know about box office, production profiles, production values, awards profiles for this movie. But as far as the story itself goes, best and worst scenes, any carryover questions that we had from the first part of this podcast, we're going to answer them here and now. So this is the spoiler section of Call Me By Your Name.
For the entire non-spoiler review, we were twiddling peaches in our hands.
If you called me by your name, it would still be my name.
Honestly, this is it's true. We do call each other by.
I can't believe it took me that long to come
up with
that joke.
You by your name. You do call me by your name. Time. You do call me by your name. Anyway, yeah, not something with all the gender norms the way they are. Not something a straight couple would even think about unless their names were like Warren and Pat or something. Honestly,
I think those are the original names of these two characters.
Don't get offended by me saying that, but it's just not something we would think of.
Warren Moon and Pat from SNL.
Right. The character I mean, Pat. It just wouldn't come.
Which was the original casting as well.
But it does. The theme works. Those scenes
work. I got to tell you, that part, it took me a while to come up with a rationale for what you call me by your name and I'll call you by mine, where that fit in terms of, like, I get it's supposed to be a grand romantic gesture. I just, in my head, I was like, what is that?
It is about the seeing a beauty in the other person. And the other person, it makes you beautiful.
But it also...
That's the worst of times.
It also... Yeah, that's racist.
I can't be racist against myself,
it
though, also,
can I? You want to go right into worst scenes? Best scenes, worst scenes?
No, let's just hit the peach, right? So we have to talk about
this. Is that what
we're
calling it?
Yeah, we
do. All right, let's hit the peach.
Let's just hit the peach, as Timothy Chalamet.
So,
take 37...
There is a peach scene in this movie, and if you've yet to see this movie and you're in the spoiler section for some reason, it's American Pie with a peach.
I can't believe they pulled this off as one of the more emotional scenes of the movie, because the kid, again, showing a character's flaws, Timothy Chalamet is immediately humiliated in that scene when Armie Hammer finds him out. It breaks him down emotionally. Like, the kid's been in love all day, and he's sitting around just panting and sighing.
He is more tender and caring with that piece of fruit than I have ever been with any human in my life.
We have man hands.
You want to talk about a me problem?
So Armie Hammer immediately sees what the kid's done with the peach, right? But again, showing flawed characters, like the kid, Timothy Chalamet's becomes sexually active that weekend, right? With the girl, with Hammer, and then with the peach, and then with Oliver again. But so he can't stop, as we all were when we were 18.
He's exploring his sexuality,
and he's ashamed by it. And then
Society has taught him to be ashamed by it. He's ashamed for the same reason that Armie Hammer has already expressed they can't go forward with their love previously.
So Hammer, Oliver almost takes a bite out of it, trying to make it like kinky, and then he stops because he realizes that the kid's like broken down. So the kid, they basically realize they're in love with each other in that scene, because Oliver doesn't force the kinkiness on him. He doesn't make the kid, he feels bad, and he protects Elio in that scene from his humiliation.
He doesn't
humiliate the kid. And that meant a lot to me rewatching it. I was squirming the first time. The second time I kind of paid attention to it. It was like, oh my God, they just freaking made American Pie.
Yeah.
An artistic triumph. Movie, yeah. I can't freaking believe that. Are you kidding me?
But that peach also, that kind of helped my worst scene, because as a straight guy, again, it's a me problem going into that scene for the first time. You're kind of like, oh my God, what's actually happening? But when you take a step back and you realize the artistic value of it, and there is tons of it there, like you just said, the problem I have, and it's not a worst scene, it's a worst ideal, is that Armie Hammer, to me, is the one throughout this whole movie that's kind of had to play the stop-start game, because it seems like if the Timothy Chalamet character was left to his own devices,
right,
everything would be fully fleshed out in their relationship prior to this point. We have the scene in the grassy knoll where Timothy Chalamet's kind of mounted him and ready to go, and Armie Hammer puts the brakes on.
Right.
The scene with the peach, Armie Hammer's the one that's got his character's got to almost bite through, a semen peach, for lack of a better word, and he stops because he's caring. He's the one that has Timothy Chalamet, that, once he stops Timothy Chalamet, Chalamet wants to keep going and puts his
hand
on his crotch.
Chalamet's the aggressor, and right. Yeah, he's resisting it. He's been there,
and
done
it's,
that
it's Hammer's character that has the more worldly view that's looking out for the bull. Both of them. So in my estimation, I think Armie Hammer's performance is the one that's more on the line, because Chalamet almost is like, like you said, a horny teenager that wants to keep going and going and going.
And Chalamet's not grown up in a household that forbids this sort of thing, that looks down on it. He gets rebuked from his father for calling their visiting gay friends. Mm-hmm. Andre Aciman plays one of those two actors, actually. And Guadagnino said he was a really good actor, it turns out. And yeah, I couldn't tell in the performance. Looking back, I mean, I guess it makes sense. But So, yeah, I mean, this kid is it's not been demonized in his household like most other households in the 1980s, presumably. So he does not, like Armie Hammer mentions later on, my father will kill me if he finds this out. He gets married to a woman at the end of the movie.
Has to re-suppress all those feelings. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, so.
And that, again, let's contextualize it. So at the end, you know, these two do consummate their relationship. They do hang out, make love, and they do go off on their own little trip at some point in this movie away from the parents.
But it foreshadows the tragedy there. Right. So
at the end of the movie, Armie Hammer, winter comes. Armie Hammer has had to leave. He ends up calling Timothy Chalamet months later to inform him that he's getting married to a woman.
So like you said, that the societal norms perhaps is the antagonism in the movie, but it's Armie Hammer's Oliver fighting against himself and what he
To my original point, that inner battle that Armie Hammer displays, I think Timothy Chalamet is basically like a green light the whole movie, you know, he's ready to go. Armie Hammer's the one that has to he displays more restraint and more passion because he knows when he has to start and stop,
and that's a great analogy.
It bothers me that Timothy Chalamet is being so revered for this performance, and Armie Hammer is kind of like off the side a little bit.
You're making a great point here, because the best acting that Hammer does is when he turns on the green light. The best acting that Chalamet does is when he's putting on the red light.
Forced to stop.
Because he's more. You're right. He's all systems go, and Oliver is restrain, and they both different sides of that coin, which is very. You know, it's just great drama. That works in terms of the drama.
And again, I mean, to make a wider point, this is where the movie is for me, because it's like they don't even touch each other until 53 minutes into the movie. I know, because I paused and I was like, finally. You know, like I was able to count when the movie, for me, picked up a lot. But because like I said, the non-spoiler part, I didn't feel the push and pull like Guadagnino attempted to.
Can make use of this trench coat, finally.
And, yes, exactly.
I'm sorry, I was going to make one of those... those asshole jokes. Sorry.
No, but it's like, okay, the movie finally started, and now we're all green all the time. And it's like, I can't wrap my head around, as an amateur critic, why Chalamet is so beloved and Armie Hammer is almost kind of cast aside for his nomination purposes.
No, I think if they both win, I wouldn't be surprised.
I would like it. Yeah, I wouldn't hate it. I'd say that.
We're going to talk about it.
We'll do Darkest Hour. That'll be coming up soon.
We're really going to compare and contrast in our later Oscar Sprint pods. But that's going to be a great debate. You know, we love Rockwell. Defoe, I'm a little underwhelmed by, but Rockwell versus Hammer.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. And Stuhlbarg,
people have him at number one on these major critics. Like Gold Derby has Rolling Stone, has Variety, Hollywood Reporter people up front and center on there.
And let's do a little deeper dive. I mean, do you have anything else to add there? Do you want to do a little deeper dive into Stuhlbarg's character?
Stuhlbarg just does a great job playing coy with the fact that it makes sense because you
and
have...
And against type.
But you have scenes between the Chalamet characters, Elio, and his parents, where it's obvious that, it's a lovey-dovey, which makes guys like us sick, because it's lovey-dovey with his parents, but they're affectionate scenes and meaningful scenes with the parents. Again, subtle notes being hit in terms of the quote-unquote hero's journey and all the conventions, where the mother's reading the mentor of the movie is the mother's readings of the German, fable, where I'd rather... speak or die? I forget. I'm misquoting it. But, I mean, that's at a pivotal scene. That's a meeting with the mentor scene right there before they...
And you're exposed to their different, I would say, against type mindset early on, because one of the first scenes when Chalamet is on the verge of having sex with who becomes his girlfriend, very next scene is to them at breakfast. And what's the first thing he says when he sees his father? Oh, I almost had sex with her last night.
Right.
Like, and for me, I was like, what are you doing?
And it's interesting because the father doesn't, he's like very restrained in the fact that he kind of knows what his son is. He knows
the whole time.
And the mother as well. My reading of every scene with the mother knows exactly what's going on, which was surprising for me that in the big speech, Stuhlbarg said, no, I don't think your mother knows.
Yeah.
The mother totally knows. She picks him up at the train station. She knows, man. And then
it's interesting that the mother is the one he called. I mean, when they go off, again, we got to provide a little context, but when Chalamet and Armie Hammer go off on their trip alone somewhere else in Italy, Armie Hammer finally has to leave because he's being called away on different duties, and... Chalamet calls his mother crying, asking to be picked up from the train station.
And the mother on the bench with Chalamet. To me, that's her giving him her blessing.
Interesting.
Talking about the kid, and she defends Oliver. So either the parents are so blissfully ignorant, or not blissfully ignorant, they're ignorant, because one of the funniest scenes of the movie, scene of the movie is they're at the height of their sexual tension, Elio and Oliver, and the father, archaeology professor, they just discovered the arm from the statue of the Adonis, and then they uncovered the rest of the Adonis from the sea, from the shipwreck, and of course they have to chronicle all the data from that, and Armie Hammer's like sucked in that morning. He wants to just get away from this sexual tension with Elio. And the father's like, "Oh, do you want to, you know, analyze these pictures, the slideshow of Greek Adonises all day?" I was laughing hard at that. That was funny. Armie Hammer's like, "Oh shit, here we go."
And that's an interesting point, too, is that, I mean, we talk about in Three Billboards the moments of tension that are broken with humor. We talk about in, what was it, Shape of Water, it's the same thing. There's comic relief. There's not a whole lot of comic relief in this movie.
No. I
mean, it's emotion on emotion on emotion.
Right. And it's definitely going for a different tone. But, yeah, but that scene.
That was funny. You're right. Do you have a worse scene?
I don't. I wrote down the peach after my first viewing because I was like, what the fuck? There was a what the fuck scene.
It takes you back.
Listen, I mean, you always say, Mike, you know, if you don't have a willing
partner. Sure, put this on me.
Well, you always told me throughout the years I've known you that if you don't have a willing partner or a sheep nearby, you know, you got to improvise.
Boo!
I wrote that joke. I was so proud of it.
I stepped on your momentum there. That's my fault. As it usually is,
I mean,
when I ruin your jokes.
It's tattooed on your forearm.
Right. But yes. Actually, just the picture of the sheep.
Yeah, I guess you're not proud of it.
I framed the time cover where they cloned that sheep in Scotland back in the 90s.
What are all those old fruits doing on your tabletop over there?
As much of a problem as I had with the scene in Shape of Water, you know, where it was too out of place. I think it was out of place because it didn't fit. It was shock value for shock value's sake.
Well, it's not.
This is shock value for the sake of fitting in the story.
It's not what is done. It's how it's portrayed in many ways. Well, but this is the thing. It's not treated as moral. It's treated as immoral and kind of shameful. It's not treated in a way that's glorifying peach fucking.
That's true.
It's just like this kid is ashamed of this, and it unlocks kind of an emotional next level to these two, you know, to their romance.
What about best scene? What'd you have?
So my best scene is the father's speech. I thought it's
certainly
rare.
The most emotional.
It's rare that I take a scene that's so uncinematic.
It's so on the nose. I mean, this is a straight father telling his son to be who he is.
It's an exception that makes the rule, because Guadagnino mentions it, and he's a really great student of film, that sometimes truth is the best drama. And you've seen this before, and you can't do it all the whole movie, all right? So it has to be once in a blue moon. Like, otherwise you get on the nose everything and you hate it because it's battle of the sexes, like we've mentioned time and again. But if you... once in a while, like in The Dark Knight, just state the theme.
Go for it.
You know, and they say that in screenwriting textbooks. You need to state the theme. You just have to be honest. You have to be saying something true and meaningful and state the theme.
And you want to talk about fucking inspirational. I mean, this is such a great speech, too. I mean, I'm not going to repeat it in mass.
We don't want to ruin the goddamn movie.
It's very moving. It's a very good speech.
It's a great speech. And the father's a bit of an audience surrogate in many ways. And again,
an apologist for society.
I mean, it's a movie that embraces every orientation, embraces every, like Jordan Peele said in Get Out, you need the white person surrogate somewhere at some times. Like, okay, white people, here you can relate to this person.
Yes.
He does. He purposely didn't give it to you in Get Out. He wanted you to relate to Daniel Kaluuya Daniel Kaluuya, which was great. But this is a movie that... and that worked in its own way. And yet the other side of the spectrum is that they give you this clear
there's
surrogate.
There's no wrong way to do it, but there's also no right way. Like, it's going to be – it all has to do with the lead up and the weight you give each scene prior to it, you know? And this one was done in a way that it's like – it's relatable. It's on the nose, but it works because of how it fits in this movie.
So, yeah, I mean, it was an enlightening scene. It was a scene where if you remember life in the 90s and the 2000s, God forbid, the 80s and 70s, you know, we grew up well, you know, we both grew up in religious backgrounds. Mm-hmm. We both grew up in playing a lot of sports.
Times have changed.
Times have definitely changed quite a bit.
And that was certainly, I had two best scenes. That was one. My other best scene was when Oliver and Elio finally consummated their relationship, because I was just so happy to see sex used properly in a movie storyline as opposed to Shape of Water, where I was outraged with how sex was used. Between two things.
All right. I mean, I don't know, but there's similarities to be drawn from those two scenes.
Oh, of course there are.
You don't have explicit sex in either of those scenes. They're both artfully done. There's no sex really in this movie.
But it fits in this storyline so much more fittingly than what Guillermo del Toro, to me, tried forcing into the Shape of Water.
I know you think it fits
better the other way. Go listen to our Shape of Water podcast that we did, because I lose my mind for about 30 seconds. And then Mike yells at me and tells me I was wrong for another minute and a half. So
I still don't know. We got to keep rewatching these movies as we go. We got 3 months before the big show. So like I said, the age difference did not bother me.
No, I honestly, and I said it in the non-spoiler section, didn't even know he was under 18 until you brought it up. So I can go through the movie without seeing it that way. If I had known he was underage, then yeah, it probably would have nagged at me a little bit. But again, what's underage? The age of consent, like you said, is 14 in Italy. So
I do have a problem with one thing, and it's in both Get Out and Call Me By Your Name. The shaving depicted on screen would slice your face up in a thousand different ways. Why can't anybody shave properly?
Well, you are a gorilla man.
I am a gorilla man, so I know how to shave. Like, but you can't like do little bitty... Oh my God, you're going to slice yourself up like crazy. And this thing, Kaluuya actually slices himself up, but he's like nicking and knacking at his neck. I mean, he's going to be, oh my goodness.
I have blonde hair all over my body, so I can go decade without shaving and I'm fine. Sleek as ever. I could be an Olympic swimmer, minus the whole being fat thing and sinking.
To get into towards the end.
Yeah, let's talk about the very last scene.
Elio's a realistic character. For as young as he is, again, he's very mature,
well,
right?
Well, we said that's why it's such a good movie, is because both characters are very relatable.
Throughout the movie, kind of the, like, maybe time is the antagonist, but Elio knows this is short-lived. Mm-hmm. Something that a lot of reviewers have mentioned, the flies. Like, a fly has a short lifespan. They're stuck in the, you know, this fruit orchard, essentially. They're stuck. They're basking and amongst all these fruit trees and living the good life at this villa. These flies are on screen a lot.
Yep.
It's something that they didn't try to get away from, even in the last shot, which we got to talk
about. Lands right on him, yep.
Yeah, he's got that fly. I mean, the romance is short-lived, and these flies are there. And Guadagnino won't talk about it. He won't state why he left all the flies in the movie.
Wouldn't it be funny if it was just happened to be an infestation problem? Yeah, it has no artistic value whatsoever.
They did mention that they got rains that were unprecedented in the city's history, so that the flies are there for a very, you know, natural reason,
right,
as well. I want to talk about one more series of shots that I thought was the negatives of the film are shown in a three shot, and luckily after Elio is kind of daydreaming, right? So it's in Elio. This is, I think, I can't place it in the movie, but
it's towards the end.
So it's after they've consummated or before?
I'm pretty sure it's after. I want to almost say I'm positive, but I'm not.
The actual film was deteriorating and damaged, and they ruined those three shots. It's basically the fountain shots, kind of like the poster. The fountain shots of, in Elio's mind's eye, he sees Oliver.
Are you trying to touch on what the artistic value of those shots were?
They're literally the negative of the film, because the film stock was damaged. So it's a three shot thing during kind of a musical interlude between encounters between these two.
It's funny you bring them up, because I'd almost forgotten about them completely.
Right. I remember thinking that this, all right, I got a bad copy of the movie.
Right, yeah, sure.
So it took me out of the movie for a second, and then I watched it again. I was like, all right, I got a bad copy. However, watching one of the promotional videos, Guadagnino mentioned it as one of his favorite scenes of the movie, that interlude, because that's, and he explained what happened. during one of the Q&As.
Maybe he left it in because the some of the characters are so against the archetypal character, like because the father is so against what a father usually is in this type of movie, dealing with this type of son. I mean, the negatives, it's empty.
Reminds you of the fact that this is a movie, it's an ideal. It's also a scene that's very clearly in Elio's POV. He's kind of daydreaming at the time.
But I thought Elio was in the negative with it. Yeah, it's not through his point of view. He's in the negative, isn't he? I thought it was him and Armie Hammer.
You might be right. I gotta recontextualize.
Again, this is off the top of my head because, like you said, I forgot about it.
The shots were meant to be silhouettes in general. They're just kind of heavily shadowed, regardless. So maybe that messed with the filters or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know.
But he deliberately loved that. The director loved it. He thought it added quite a lot.
And it seems the more
it was a gimmick, he admitted it.
The
was
more
a gimmick,
you look up and you more liked. You hear from Guadagnino, you see him to be more the artistic type than the straightforward storyteller, which is cool in that he was able to pull off a straightforward movie for more all intents and purposes.
Right, even though it plays with conventions in very different ways. So, yeah, to get to the ending now, it doesn't last. Do we like we said, we don't necessarily need – I don't need a sequel. I definitely don't want a sequel in 5 years. Like maybe if they came back to it like before Sunset or
That's what I have in my mind.
You know, Richard Linklater style, Ethan they Hawkins. Came back to it way later. I don't know if Asimano would write another book. You don't want to see a sequel in 3 years.
I don't want to see a sequel, period. I think it ended on such a strong note. I mean, you had – and it would have ended on a worse note for me if that smile didn't come across Chalamet's end at the end.
The speech kind of, it's great parenting, obviously.
To me, yeah. I mean, to me, that was him finally accepting that, you know, this is who I am. This is what happens. I just went through my first heartache and heartbreak, but it's okay. I survived. Yep. I still have
my
support system.
Does he win the Oscar with that scene? That's the impression that everybody gets.
And it's amazing in a no dialogue scene because it's just him. Right. It's one of those scenes where life goes on because his mother is finally going through the plates behind him. It has to do with the fly that you just talked about. It's him expressing emotion and he's crying and it goes to a smile. It's so much packed into that one
it's
little
courageous
scene.
Courageous because he doesn't blink. Right, he's staring at the flame, right?
I mean, true. Good point.
Staring contest there, like you said, a crooked smile at the end. It's a hell of a thing.
But as far as sequels, I don't need one. I don't want to see one. I think this movie stands on its own and this is a Best Picture nominee. I have no problem with this being called the Bible.
Yeah, it's undeniably good. It's like you get art films that sometimes are artsy, extra fartsy, and sometimes they're just undeniably well done. Like I said, the way he plays with conventions, this guy knows what he's doing. And when he breaks, it's very deliberate.
Give me a grade.
I have it as a B+, 89.
We're close.
I might bump it up upon rewatches.
I could see myself bumping this up if I were to take it.
I would be
again.
Surprised, but I do have it as a very strong 89.
And yeah, I was 83 for the first hour because I was just bored. I didn't like it. But 90, the love story was a 91, so I took the split the baby, 87, 88, right in there.
Right.
So I'm a strong B+ myself. A good movie. Definitely a watch, we said. You know, you're going to have your convention, your preconceived notions about it, but check it out, especially if you're in the Oscar mood. This is going to be talked about a lot leading up to and on Oscar night. So anything you want to leave with before I start plugging our stuff?
Yeah, we got a lot of good stuff coming. Stay tuned.
We're in the throes. We are off and sprinting. If this was a racetrack, we'd be off to probably about our 400-meter mark right now. Although neither you or I have completed a lap in our lives.
Those are the hardest races. I had to run a 400 once. That was a disaster.
I ate a donut at a 400 meter mark once.
yet that jerk from that jerk from South Africa runs it in a world record-breaking time last Olympics, 43.
So, So if you want to reach out to us, we love hearing from you as always. We want to hear back from you, any kind of feedback. We forgot to do the shout-outs again at the beginning of this episode. We need to do that next episode.
Next time. Sorry.
We're gonna read
some. We've been stashing them.
Read some comments on air. We'll probably get to that in the next episode. But if you have anything else you want to hear, maybe we'll read it out on air from you. You want to get to us? There's a multitude of ways. We are Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, MMO_pod on Twitter. Been talking to a couple people out on the Twitter account. That's been really fun for me. Mike and Oscar on gmail.com. We try to update those at least once a day. We've slacked a little over the holidays, but we're going to be back to it.
We twit, we gram, we F-book,
we
mail
so
electronically.
Modern.
We're like the coolest guys.
Basically, we're the 8th grade studs. shorts. Whatever.
The shorts are longer though, so we can't. We know our limits.
Well, speak for yourself. We'll see you guys
and
next
you
time.
You just stood up. Oh my god.
Until then, Mike. Reality sucks. Be sure to keep watching movies with us.
Call me Mike.
We'll see you guys next time. Later.